Ladies and gentlemen, it is my real privilege to welcome to the Slayer Report a gentleman I've always wanted to talk to. He is Dr. Nafiz Ahmed. He's a British author, investigative journalist. He's a scholar. He's the executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development, which is an independent think tank that is focused on the study of violent conflict. He's an author, a filmmaker. He's taught at the University of Sussex and Brunel University. His focus academically is on the systemic causes of mass violence, something I'm very interested in. He used to blog for The Guardian, and he now has a very interesting and important new initiative called InSurge Intelligence, which I'm going to ask him to talk to you about. But I first became aware of his work on 9/11. He's done some remarkable writing and speaking on 9/11, but he has a new, as I said, this new initiative for InSurge Intelligence, and he's got a new series on Google that is just absolutely, you know, it's Six Sigma. It's a 10 out of 10, and I can't encourage you enough to read it. And after you read it, sort of strip Google from your life. But with no further ado, Nafiz, welcome to the Slayer Report, and thank you for joining us all the way from London.
Thanks for having me, Catherine. It's an honor to be able to speak to you about all this.
When I read this, I kept seeing the line from the movie, "By George, he's got it." So tell us about the Google series. It's a 2-part series, and if you could just lead us through it and start with what inspired you to do this. And I think I just have to tell you, I think it's a remarkable contribution to our understanding of the world.
Yeah, I mean, it started off kind of very unexpectedly. I mean, I've been writing about the context and the drivers behind mass surveillance for a few years. In the context of some of the stuff I've done on security and counterterrorism and all that stuff. Especially since the Snowden revelations I think a lot of the stuff that Snowden revealed was already kind of known. It already entered into the public record in different ways in the preceding decades since 9/11. But I think, you know, with Snowden, we had kind of, it was the nail in the coffin in a way. And, you know, we now had, you know, abundant, clear documentation of the vast extent of the national security apparatus and what it was doing in the name of security, but in a way which, you know, we now know to some extent really has very little to do with security, but more to do with power and control and all sorts of other things. So my interest in looking into the issue of surveillance and its intersections with national security and foreign policy was all about really trying to explore the why, not so much the fact that it's happening, which I think, you know, many have actually known for a while and been talking about for a while, but really why is it happening and where is it coming from and what are the interests, you know, behind this whole drive to kind of control information in this way. So that's something I've been really keen to kind of understand and kind of also, you know, kind of just open up more dialogue and debate about that, which I think there's not been enough discussion about really how to make sense of this and what, you know, what is the kind of driving factors behind this. So, you know, when I started kind of looking into all of this stuff when I was at The Guardian, I did a couple of stories about the role of the Pentagon in kind of doing kind of like preparations for big domestic crises, as well as crises internationally, but a lot of stuff about the potential for kind of insurgencies. I mean, the term domestic insurgencies was bandied around quite a lot in a number of Pentagon documents. There was a lot of concern about the impact of kind of unpredictable shocks and like economic shocks or food shocks or energy shocks and so on and so forth. So I got this sense that there was this, here you had this kind of like this military establishment that was being asked to draw up plans for how to react when, in a way, well, you know, to do you mind my French, when the shit hits the fan? And what do we do when people get angry and upset and the state, states become a little bit more challenged and it's difficult to govern? You know, what do we do? What's the military response? So a lot of that stuff was then, and I think a lot of it kind of fed into and gave some explanation for why we saw a lot of the things that Snowden revealed. And so that kind of just led me on this journey into just looking more and more deeper into, you know, reading all kinds of random stuff about, you know, what the Pentagon was doing. So I ended up keeping tabs on, I guess, certain kind of unclassified stuff that was being put out by the Pentagon, but that most journalists, you know, would not necessarily pick up. So one thing that interested me was when Chuck Hagel, obviously, you know, the current defense secretary, but he's basically been, he's been asked to resign, if you believe the various reports that have come out from people in the White House, you know, anonymous sources saying that basically the White House and a number of people basically got fed up with him and wanted him to go. And that actually does tie into some of the things that I'm going to talk about. But so that was something that intrigued me, because the week before his resignation was announced, he had announced this thing called the Defense Innovation Initiative, which was this massive new program to basically, in a way, upgrade the Pentagon, kind of take control of cutting-edge technologies, disruptive technologies, information technology, robotics, artificial intelligence, biogenetics, all kinds of, fancy technologies that normally you would kind of think, you know, belongs to the realm of science fiction. And when I was looking into this, and I wrote a piece about it for Vice, for their tech magazine, Motherboard, and I found this white paper that had been published by the National Defense University in D.C., which basically looked like the blueprint for what the Defense Innovation Initiative was. And it had been published 2 months before the initiative had been announced by Hagel. And it had been authored by two longtime Pentagon kind of people who've been kind of working essentially as advisors or in a senior level as advisors or officials inside the Pentagon for decades. And one of them was a guy called Linton Wells, who I, you know, ended up finding out he was linked to this thing called the Highlands Forum. And at the time, I hadn't really thought very much of it, but from the few bits and pieces that I found on the web, which is very little, really, in terms of mainstream coverage, there were a couple of articles here and there. There was one article in Government Executive from 2006, which talked about this Highlands Forum entity, which had been apparently sponsored by the Pentagon through the Office of the Secretary of Defense, set up in 1994 to basically do work on information technology and its relevance to the Pentagon, and it's apparently been running seamlessly since then. So Linton Wells was connected to this, and I surmised that this appears to have been, you know, one of the avenues by which he and his paper, you know, was clearly plugged into that policymaking process, which occurred inside the Pentagon at a high level, which resulted in, you know, what we saw being announced by Hagel a week before he ended up getting chucked out.
Nafis, is it possible Hagel got chucked out because he was stepping on the toes of the private guys who wanted to control those areas?
Well, actually, yeah, that's kind of what I think.
Yeah,
and I do kind of I mentioned briefly. But the issues with Hagel. But what was interesting was, I mean, we know that Hagel came in with, a kind of very, very outspoken and critical view of the Iraq War to some extent. I mean, it wasn't necessarily as critical as some of us would have liked it to be, but he was quite outspoken, and he's also been very outspoken about Israel and the U.S. relationship to Israel. So he's someone who clearly was not a traditional part of that kind of defense establishment, but someone who had been a figure who had his own perspective and his own opinion. And what was interesting is that when he was asked to redraft budgets, And this is also, again, what kind of led me to kind of dig deeper, because I was actually trying to find out why Hegel had been chucked out in this way when I was doing this story. And it was just like, it didn't add up, because a lot of the press was just saying, yeah, you know, he didn't, you know, there were lots of different stories coming out, like he didn't gel with certain people, and then they were all very inconsistent stories. But then one thing struck me was there were a number of reports that pointed out that when he was, you know, kind of administering the budget sequestration and kind of deciding what to cut, one of the things that there were rumors circulating, and the rumors were so strong about Hegel's apparent desire to shut down the Pentagon's internal think tank called the Office of Net Assessment, which is headed up by this guy, a legendary figure known as Andrew Marshall, who was first appointed by Richard Nixon and has basically headed up the ONA since then. And what was interesting was that a number of sources affiliated with the ONA had said last year that Hegel's apparent desire to shut down the ONA was basically, they called it strategic suicide. And interestingly, no one really talked about that stuff, you know, when he actually, his resignation was announced. But that kind of raised some flags for me, as in, what did this have something to do with what happened? And when I started looking into it more, it became very clear that Hegel was definitely trying to reduce the clout of the ONA. And it was so prominent and annoying for certain people that six former defense secretaries, including Robert Gates, wrote a letter to the Obama administration basically saying, you know, this is outrageous. How could he attempt to shut down the ONA? And in the end, you know, the formal response from the government was, no, we're not trying to shut it down. We're just trying to rearrange it and kind of just make it more efficient. But one of the questions that was raised at the time was, why are you trying to shut down, in the name of cutting budgets, an entity which, compared to, you know, all the other things which gets loads of spending, really doesn't take that much spending, because really it's just like a small think tank which does a lot of apparently very important work, which is what the argument was of these six defense secretaries, on futures planning and scenario planning and that kind of stuff. But ultimately, you know, because it's kind of think tank stuff and research, doesn't cost very much. So that indicated that Hegel was really trying to slide through under this kind of guise of, okay, I'm trying to sort the budgets out. In that process, he was trying to basically take on the ONA. And so I kind of was wondering that, you know, what was this about? And when I started to look deeper into it, I found that actually it turns out that Andrew Marshall, who is head of the ONA, is also involved in this thing called the Highlands Forum, and he co-chairs the Highlands Forum, and also the head of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, also co-chairs the Highlands Forum. And there are apparently a number of other agencies which are heavily involved in the Highlands Forum. So, you know, I began to kind of look more into it, and it seemed to me that there was so little information on this entity that had been set up by the Pentagon in 1994, essentially to study information operations and to kind of catalyze information in the private sector and bring it into the Pentagon so that the Pentagon could stay on top of developments that are going on and kind of bring those into the way that it does information operations and develop strategy and policy on information operations across government. And that was what basically the Highlands Forum was about, according to Pentagon records. And when I began to look deeper into that, Google began to come up in terms of the relationships between Google executives and people involved in the Highlands Forum. And then that was when it ended up, you know, this whole kind of can of worms opened up. And I began to look more into Google and ended up uncovering stuff which was actually quite accessible if you looked for it, but no one had really decided to look for it. But very clear evidence that Google had been directly funded by an intelligence community program run by the CIA and the NSA.
Right. I told you the story this weekend by email of how, I guess it was in 1998, it was after my, you know, they'd stolen my software and the squabble, my squabble had begun with them. Someone who I didn't know very well and didn't trust at the time, I just didn't know them, came to me and said, you know, the CIA is going to start a search engine and they're going to use a lot of the stuff you and a lot of other people have discovered, and it's going to be called Google. So I didn't think anything of it. And then when I first saw Google, which was, I don't know, a couple months later, I think, I said, oh, you know, I guess this is it. But I always assumed from the beginning that this was a creature created by the intelligence agencies.
I think some people certainly did. And I think, I think Silicon Valley and the way in which Silicon Valley kind of erupted, you know, in that time, it's not entirely, you know, controversial to recognize that the Pentagon and agencies like DARPA especially took a very keen interest in Silicon Valley. I mean, even DARPA takes credit for creating the internet.
Right.
So a lot of that, to some extent, is not controversial at all. But I think what makes it interesting is really the extent to which Google has gone out of its way to deny having any kind of relationship with the intelligence community. And contrast that with the extent of the information that is now, you know, that I've basically brought out, which really appears to really make it quite clear that Google had a very close relationship to the intelligence community before it was even incorporated as a company. And I think that's something that I found quite surprising. And very also surprising the way in which Google responded, because they just completely have, to this day, continued to deny it. And also just be not responsive to very specific questions. And it comes back to this initiative called the Massive Digital Data Systems Initiative, which I can't even remember exactly how I ended up stumbling across it. But this initiative was established around the 1990s. It ran from around 1992 to 1999. And interestingly, the person who was managing it at the time was a woman who is now a very distinguished academic, recognized for her expertise in data mining and data mining for counterterrorism. Her name is Professor Bhavani Thurasingam. And at that time, she was still an academic. She had a PhD, but she was working for a private firm known as the Mitra Corporation, which is well known as a leading defense contractor. And apparently, Mitra, according to Thurasingam, was basically managing this program, the MDDS, the Massive Digital Data Systems Initiative, on behalf of the U.S. intelligence community. Now, I interviewed Thurasingam about this for the story, and she also made a number of comments about the program in a couple of articles that she posted on the University of Texas website, where she's now a director of the Cyber Research, I think Cyber Security Research Institute it's called. And those documents, I mean, she even talks about it in her CV. She very clearly states and reaffirmed to me in our interview that Sergey Brin, who was at Stanford at the time, was partly funded by the MDDS program. And she also posted a copy of the abstract for the MDDS program, which made clear that this was basically being run by three main agencies of the intelligence community: the DCI, which is, it specifically mentioned the community management staff. Now, the community management staff basically is kind of an interagency group which coordinates staff across the intelligence community under the remit of the DCI, which is the Director of Central Intelligence. The other agencies that were involved were the CIA's Office of Research and Development and the National Security Agency. And it named the officers who were involved in administering the program. They included Thurasingam, who was the lead manager of the program, which was basically being outsourced via Mitra, as well as her colleague, Rick Steinheiser, who at that time was a senior officer in the CIA's Office of Research and Development. And they were the two main people who were managing it at Stanford. And what she said was that from 96 to 98, Sergey Brin received funding from the MDDS through Stanford University. The program was being managed by Professor Jeffrey Ullman, who is a leading computer scientist. A number of other students were also receiving funding under the MDDS. What was happening, apparently, every 3 months or so, from 96 to 98, Sergey Brin was actually personally meeting with Thrasingham and Steinheiser and briefing them about the progress of his research, specifically on the development of the Google search engine. Now, what's interesting is that none of this is necessarily particularly unusual, because, you know, the MDDS was, from what I gather, it was an unclassified program, but it was sensitive in the sense that, you know, clearly information about the program is not widely available. There's not been really any kind of public record stuff about it. There are no kind of easily available documents in public about this program. But there were snippets of it. It's been described by Thrasingham. You know, I ended up finding bits and pieces about it in stuff that she talked about in prefaces to various books that she'd written. It's been mentioned in you know, a couple of journal articles, out, you know, offhand here and there. But, you know, it's very, very kind of vague. There's nothing more, you know, there's nothing official about it. I mean, I managed to find an email that had been put out as a research call to the computer science community in the United States on one email list. But that was all. So clearly, I mean, I spoke to a couple of people in the intelligence community who used to work in intelligence who said to me that, you know, this, you know, we can't say for sure, but it seems that it was probably a sensitive but unclassified program. So what this kind of shows very clearly is that Sergey Brin was associated with the intelligence community at this time, and that, in fact, I mean, Thrasingham said that the money that the MDDS had provided wasn't a huge amount of money. It was, he probably got more money from elsewhere, you know, from his NSF, his National Science Foundation grant, and, you know, some other grants in the private sector, I think Hitachi and IBM.
But let me just step in here for a second, because how these things go, and it's always impossible for you as an investigative journalist to say this, but I'm an investment person, so I'll say it. What happens is the decision is made, okay, we want this to go, and so, you know, you put in a little money directly, but then you arrange for other agencies too, and then you call certain people in the private sector and you arrange for them to do that too. And, you know, and so money comes in from anywhere from 2 to 10 or 20 different directions, but it's all been arranged. And that's why, yeah.
I think what's interesting about this is that it doesn't actually matter whether it was arranged or whether it was an accident, because one thing that was interesting is that Steinheiser has had a very long relationship with Stanford University. And I found this letter from these archives of a computer scientist, a renowned computer scientist who pioneered research in artificial intelligence. His name was, I think, Eric Feigenbaum. And Steinheiser was going to, according to this letter, he was going to visit Feigenbaum as long as, like, I think it was 20 years ago. He was going to Stanford. That was 1983, actually. I think the letter was dated. And the letter was literally about Steinheiser coming and finding, they were just giving him parking directions to where to find parking on campus. But the point is that he at that time, he was affiliated to the Office of Naval Research. Now, what we see here is that someone like Steinheiser, who clearly at that time he was involved in some kind of AI research, there was an AI steering committee of some kind inside the intelligence community linked to the Office of Naval Research where he was at, and he was going to Stanford and he was talking to this guy. So there were clearly long-standing relationships here going far back, And we also know that DARPA had also had long-standing relationships with Stanford. They had been funding Feigenbaum, for decades, millions of dollars they had given him for all kinds of different research. You know, DARPA had funded Jeffrey Ullman. DARPA had funded many of the financiers that also put in seed funding for Google. So, you know, it kind of depends, you know, where it doesn't really matter where you stand on this ideologically. I mean, you can kind of, for most people who understand how CIA operations work, they're beginning to realize that this is how the CIA kind of tends to do things. If it wants to kind of conceal something, it has to go through front companies and front operations. The whole point is that the CIA is not just going to come and say, here's some money, let's just do it, and everyone can see that we're doing it. No, you've got to try and do it discreetly. And in this case, I think they were actually a little less discreet in the sense that you had this program that was clearly being run by the CIA and the NSA, and that was actually giving money out to certain people. But what's interesting is that whether or not you think that it was done as part of a preconceived arrangement, or you consider that Sergey Brin, you know, went to Stanford, he was in the right place at the right time, you know, he was a bit of a genius. Him and Larry Page came up with this amazing idea, and they were in a prime position at this time when the CIA and the NSA were all over Stanford and they were looking for stuff, and then they found Brin. But what's very clear is that, you know, Steinheiser and Thrasingham took a very specific interest in what Brin was doing. Why were they seeing him every 3 months? They were traveling down to Stanford, from wherever they worked, every 3 months to kind of get an update on his progress. Then you take it all together, you corroborate all of that with the way in which Google continued to kind of be having these relationships with the intelligence community. I mean, for example, the CIA guy who said to you that, you know, the CIA is going to launch Google. You know, it's very clear that, you know, and you're not the only person. Robert Steele, who was a former CIA official for the last 26 years or so, I mean, he's now retired. He was there for about 26 years. He basically also had come out in 2006 and said that a number of CIA sources had told him that Steinheiser was the liaison with Google for the CIA and had actually arranged funding. So, you know, it depends how you look at it. But I think when you bring all of these factors together, there's no doubt whatsoever that the CIA, the intelligence community, the moment they recognized what Brin was doing, at the very least, is they basically essentially took ownership over what he was doing and made sure that they could operationalize it. And that's really what the MDES is about.
Right.
Because when the abstract that Thrasingham put up on the University of Texas website, you just scroll down to the bottom, and there's a lot of interesting information in there, and that's in the few paragraphs that are there about what the MDES is about. But you go to the bottom, and it says the customers for this program of research are DOD, intelligence community, and other potential government agencies.
So let me step back.
Being funded for, you know, yeah. Brin was being funded for. It was to produce something that would be useful for the Pentagon, for the intelligence community.
So let me step back and look at it from a high level view. The shadow government had a problem at the end of, you know, so the wall comes down in 89-90, and they've been, you know, I think a lot of the technology in Silicon Valley was seeded out of the black budget. So they're re-engineering stuff or reverse engineering stuff out of the black budget and sort of putting it in Silicon Valley. And, you know, it's a very organic process. They don't quite know where all this is going to go. And what's developing out in Silicon Valley is technology that could literally re-engineer the financial industry out of existence, not to mention significantly re-engineer the defense budget and the military, everything else. And they needed to get a handle on it. And I think they did two things. One is, you know, they poured money in and pumped and dumped Silicon Valley. You know, in 98, Silicon Valley was full of people who wanted to reinvent the world and make the world safe for humanity and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you go back 10 years later and it's basically a group of defense contractors. So That was number one. But I think number two was, how do we run a global empire with a friendly face? And, you know, they came out of World War II with a great sort of spin as to why the U.S. was a friendly face when it wasn't. And they kept the violence very covert. And I think the question was, okay, now that we're the only global superpower, how do we do that? And, you know, they took one look at this technology and said, okay, this is how we do it. You know, we basically have complete information awareness of every person, you know, but we, how do you market that? Well, you need young, friendly entrepreneurs like Brin or Mark Zuckerberg, who make the kids and the young people just grab this and go. So this is a way to, you know, so to me, these guys are all just friendly fronts, and they don't really even understand what happened. You know, it's funny because you see the intelligence community get around one entrepreneur and not around the other. And the other one is hardworking and has a great product, and he can't understand why his thing is not going. And yet this other guy, it's going, you know, in speedy, miraculous ways. Everything's... Yeah. It just keeps coming together. It's all synchronicity.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is the thing. I mean, if you think about it from the perspective of someone like, you know, Brin or Page, you're a student at Stanford, you're doing your PhD, and you know, you're developing this technology, and you know, suddenly there are people around you who are like, we're going to give you money. This is going to be huge.
Right.
Opportunities, and then you've got doors opening, you know, to government and even, you know, intelligence, and you feel important, and it's like you're saving, you're helping to save people, and you're helping to, you know, it's a well-known thing. I mean, one of the things that people always say is when the CIA is trying to basically bring people into the fold, it's all about making you feel good, making
right.
sure that you're contributing, making you feel important. And, you know, it's very easy you could imagine, like, that, you know, a younger tech entrepreneur seeing that, their eyes just kind of lighting up at the world opening up to them, you know, in a way that they would never have imagined, you know, before. And this is certainly something that has been happening across the board. But what's really fascinating about the story of Google and the other kind of tech companies related to it is the extent to which people inside the intelligence community and people who may not be in the intelligence community but are closely aligned with the intelligence community, you know, whether they're wealthy financiers or bankers or whatever, the extent to which you have people who are sympathetic to the Pentagon and its values or embedded in those networks, you know, that having their fingerprints on these kind of tech startups like Facebook, Google, and others is absolutely mind-blowing. And that was what, you know, when I started looking at the connections to the Pentagon's Highlands Forum, which actually does exactly like what you were saying in terms of this idea of, well, wait a minute, you know, we've got this global empire. How do we find a way to run this and keep people happy? And you know, we need to do this. The answer is information. It's extraordinary to see how precisely that mindset was apparent inside the Highlands Forum, which was all about information and information warfare and information operations. And the guy who was asked by William Perry, who at that time was Clinton's defense secretary, Perry apparently asked this guy, Richard O'Neill, who was a former Navy cryptologist who had gone on to become a Pentagon staffer. He was asked, you know, set up this thing, the Highlands Forum, you know, and eventually they decided they were going to set it up in the private sector rather than making it a formal Pentagon thing, which it seemed was, according to Richard O'Neill, you know, was all about basically avoiding bureaucracy, avoiding kind of regulatory restrictions, allowing no holds barred discussions, essentially basically keeping it outside of the spectrum of any kind of public scrutiny, it seemed. And they set this thing up. And what was really interesting was that Richard O'Neill, who'd now founded and set up and was now running this Highlands Forum thing, and he was bringing, you know, private contractors like Booz Allen Hamilton and Science Applications National Corporation, You know, he has Google executives coming and people from eBay and PayPal and Cisco, and people who are closely connected to the very financiers who even gave seed funding to Google. And you know, just, you know, we can go on and on about the networks that were involved in this, but you know, he was convenient, he was together. But in the 1970s, according to Colonel John Alexander, who was another former senior U.S. intelligence official, and he wrote in a book talking about all a whole wide range of things, but in his book, he mentioned that Richard O'Neill wrote this paper for the U.S. Navy as part of his thesis all about information operations. And apparently the paper identified three main targets for information warfare, and it was called a strategy for perception management. And according to John Alexander, this was actually the first time that this idea of perception management had been articulated in such a kind of cogent way. And of course, information operations have been a core part of you know, U.S. Policy and, you know, British policy and Western policy for many decades before then. But he said this was the first time it had really been kind of really coherently kind of worked out. And the three main targets, interestingly, were obviously there's the adversary, and the idea was to make the adversary feel vulnerable. The second target, he said, were kind of governments and partners, and that included the domestic government. And it was, the idea was that they need to kind of feel that they have to kind of be involved and support the policy that the U.S. government has adopted, or the Pentagon has adopted. And the third target of information warfare are general publics who have to be convinced that the cost is worth it. And that's kind of an extraordinary set of kind of three targets for information warfare that we see. And, you know, what apparently John Alexander said, apparently this scheme was kind of like went all the way up to and was presented to the top kind of leadership of the Pentagon. And apparently they said that they thought it was a really good idea, but then in his words, they buried it. But what's interesting is that, you know, I'm not sure why John Alexander said that they buried it, whether is that disinformation or whatever it is, or maybe he didn't know. But, you know, the Highlands Forum that was now being set up and run by Richard O'Neill was set up to exactly do what he had actually described in that paper. And so it's no coincidence that we then see the Highlands Forum being used by the Pentagon as this nexus to literally canvas what was going on in the private sector, and especially bringing information technology experts and entrepreneurs, and, you know, kind of really scouring the market to see what is next, what is on the edge, what is the kind of the next big thing that's going to happen, and how can we incorporate this into what the Pentagon is doing.
There are two stories I want to tell you. One is 1990. I was a subscriber to Esther Dyson's newsletter at the time in the 90s. And she used to have a conference once a year out in the desert. And, you know, everybody was anybody in the information technology world would go. And I was out there in 97, and there were venture capitalists who were throwing huge amounts of money at all the entrepreneurs. So you'd go see a presentation, and an entrepreneur would have an idea, and it was very clever, but it was never going to go. You know, it was never going to make a difference to two busy parents with two kids, and, you know, it was never going to make a difference. There was really no market, but it was a very neat, clever idea. And the place was just inundated with venture capitalists, and the entrepreneur needed $25,000 to prototype his idea, and the guy was, you know, saying, I'll give you $10 million, but you have to take at least $10 million. Yep. And I'll never forget Bill Ryan, who was the PR guy for Yahoo Finance, and I. We just got freaked, and we went early and had lunch and said, what, you know, because you had guys handing out $10 million at a time to things that were clearly never going to go. And of course, what happened is they all got sort of pumped up and then sold into the pension funds in a huge pump and dump. And, you know, so a couple years later, I finally understood. But when that process was over, Nafis, You know, Silicon Valley was owned by Wall Street. They'd been pumped and dumped, and it was all over. You know, Wall Street was the king, including the, you know, and really a lot of it was now oriented to serving defense. And so there was a real integration of the national security infrastructure with what was going, you know, sort of all the young guys on Silicon Valley. So that's story number one. Story number two, I have to tell you, it was I'm sitting in Hamilton Securities, and we prided ourselves in 1995 for being one of the leading, you know, sort of using computer technology in creative ways. Anyway, so my chief financial officer comes to me and he says, we need a personnel system. I said, that's a complete waste of time and money. I don't want a personnel system. He said, no, we have to have it. I said, okay, at the end of this year, we're going to require every employee to build an HTML website about themselves on the intranet, and then we'll stitch them together, and that'll be our personnel system. And so that's what we did. And then when Facebook came along, I said, oh, you know, they're going to do it for the world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You don't want to get me started on I have lots of Facebook stories I'd love to tell you. You know, it's the same kind of thing. You know, the agency's going to create a blah, blah, blah. But, you know, so you've written the series on Google. I hope you'll write the series on Facebook. But one of the things I wanted to tell you was, so I get out to Esther Dyson's thing in 97, and who's got the big table is Goldman Sachs. Because Goldman Sachs was right in the middle of everything. And, of course, you nailed it, because the key to getting these things to go is they have to go financially. And that's always the question. How do you figure out how to get this thing to go financially? And part of that is, how do you make sure it has a successful IPO? And, you know, you breed it up through the venture space, but then you get it to the point where it can go in the market, and you got to get it to go with investors. So firms like Goldman play a very critical role in all of that. Anyway, so I hope your next series is going to be Facebook.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting you mention all of that, because, I mean, Esther Dyson is actually a longstanding member of the Pentagon Highlands Forum. I don't know if you were aware of that.
Oh, I'm not today, but I will regale you with Esther Dyson stories.
she's obviously been going along quite a lot. So the nexus that you experienced is also interesting, because, yes, Goldman Sachs just keeps coming up repeatedly in relation to all the tech stuff.
Yeah.
But what was really fascinating about it was how direct some of the connections were. I mean, apart from the fact that we see that revolving door between Goldman Sachs executives and, for example, you know, Stephen Friedman, who, you know, was a former chairman, and he was on the executive board only until, I think, last year or something, but when he stepped down, but had been asked to serve, I think, under President Bush on the Intelligence Advisory Committee.
Right.
And had played all kinds of kind of roles in various kind of investigations into intelligence, and had in that context been in close contact with people involved in the NSA and the National Geospatial Agency and other specifically other types of agencies, because of the investigations, the government inquiries into intelligence that he was involved in. But apart from that, there was the whole connection with George C. Lee, who I was surprised to find was the main guy who had funded a new partnership between the Pentagon Highlands Forum and the Monterey Institute for International Studies and their Cyber Security Research Initiative. And this partnership, where now it seemed the Highlands Forum was going to be doing a lot of sessions in liaison with the MIIS, but George C. Lee was the guy who basically put down a lot of the. We don't know exactly how much; it's not been publicly disclosed. But he put down from himself personally the money that allowed this initiative to take off. But he's also the same guy who was responsible for some of those massive valuations of Facebook and also
right.
Google and eBay and PayPal. And so that precise nexus that you talk about, where you see how, rather than it's like, you know, there's the CIA sitting there thinking, well, we're just going to put money into something, which of course actually they are now doing through their private venture firm.
They always do it so they make money.
Absolutely. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's interesting how it's all about networks, and it's all about, rather than it just being this kind of very easy, obvious thing that you can see, it's all about networks of influence and the fact that, well, there's so many of these people, you know, in Goldman Sachs, for example, which clearly is one of the go-to firms in terms of, you
right.
want something done, you want money raised for your favored tech company, well, that's who you go to. And I think that was something that I found really fascinating when I was doing the story about how it wasn't so much a case of, you know, in a kind of like traditional maybe conspiracy that you might think, it's, you know, it's a very simplistic case of the intelligence community putting money into something directly, but rather this case of, you have these incestuous, you know, relationships between Wall Street and the intelligence community, which have gone back decades, and which are constantly kind of just mobilizing through these personal relationships, which are just cementing those ties. I think that for me was
right.
something I've been aware of, but I was quite shocked actually at the extent to which it seemed to be operating in relation to a lot of these big names that we see all the time that have now.
Well, but here's why, and you think of or many people think of the U.S. government as a government. I don't think of the U.S. government as a government. It's not a sovereign government. It doesn't have information sovereignty. It doesn't have financial sovereignty. If you look at the bank accounts for the U.S. government, they're run by the New York Fed as depository, which means they're run by the agent banks, including Goldman Sachs. And if you go into a big financial operation in government like HUD, you know, all the servicing and mortgage portfolios are run by the big New York Fed member banks, and they have control and they have information control the government officials don't. In what you're describing on Chuck Hagel was, he may have been trying to revert things to government bureaucracy control. And it's the same thing with IT. You know, when most people see the U.S. government, they see 21 government agencies. I see 5 defense contractors who control all the databases. You know, when I was assistant secretary, I used to try and get data on the Section 8 program, and Lockheed Martin wouldn't give it to me. I couldn't make them give me my own data. So, you know, so it's a much more integrated, complex picture that is different than sort of what the, you know, what it looks like. And here's one other thing I want to bring up before we close. And that is, you know, at the same time that this is going on, you have a literal financial coup d'etat going on, including $4 trillion go missing through the government, very much engineered through the information systems. And I suspect that that is a story that is connected to, yeah. you know, the marvelous story you've written. I'm calling it the Google series. and you know, if you have not yet talked to Bill Hamilton, who was the former NSA employee who started Insula, who built Promise Software, and you're interested in that aspect, you know, I would encourage you to do it. But there's so many different interesting aspects to your story. That leads me to what we can do, and one of the things we can do is support your InSurge intelligence. So why don't you tell us about that and what's next for you?
So, I mean, I was at The Guardian. I mean, I've been a freelance independent journalist for almost 14 years now, mostly writing for places like The Guardian, The Independent, and various other places, Foreign Policy, Atlantic, you know, just pitching in as it goes along. And I got a gig at The Guardian, which was great, and I had a contract and everything else. And I wrote a couple of stories which seemed to be essentially pissing my editors off. I was writing a lot of I was lucky enough that when I had my contract, I had complete editorial control as part of my contract. So it was a very rare type of agreement. It was a really great gig, but it also meant that I would often put my mouth in the lion's my head in the lion's mouth, realizing it, because I wasn't going directly through an editor. I was just posting stuff to the website. And I kind of really apparently crossed a real line when I wrote a story about Gaza and Israel's Operation Protective Edge. And it's something that I've been following for many years, the role of Gaza's gas and the gas resources that have been discovered offshore in the Gaza Marine, and the role of how those resources have increasingly kind of problematized the conflict and made it much more intractable and complicated it and taken it in these unexpected directions. So I wrote a story which brought in the gas connection, and certainly was not trying to argue that the whole conflict was all about resources, but trying to demonstrate the extent to which resources are increasingly playing this very important role in these kinds of conflicts. But literally, the day I posted that article, the day after I posted the article, I got a call from one of my senior editors, and they literally just unilaterally just told me that my contract is terminated, and that was it.
So this was more offensive than what Glenn Greenwald did with Snowden.
Yeah.
I just want to point that out.
It's weird because obviously after that experience, that was quite an egregious kind of form of censorship as far as I could see. I mean, I've not seen something like that happen, and it's supposed to, you know, The Guardian is one of the better papers.
Right.
There's still, problems with the coverage and limitations and all the rest of it. But I was quite shocked to see a liberal paper do that in that way. So it kind of just made me, and that's not one of the things that I've been doing in terms of all this information stuff is looking at all of, and I'm sure you've also been covering this kind of stuff as well, is the extent to which information technology has in many ways transformed our economy, but also opened up so many new possibilities for distributed distributed technologies, whether it's in terms of energy or finance. There is this whole emerging movement now, which is very difficult for centralized states to control and to co-opt and to benefit from and to profit from in the way that they used to. And certainly things like solar energy and this new kind of, Bitcoin and all these other things, whatever one might think of them, they're certainly challenging a lot of these traditional modes of doing things. And that made me kind of just think more and more about trying to set up media which is independent and which is not accountable to corporate financing and not accountable to government funding, but accountable to people. And then that was when I thought, well, maybe this is the right time. And that's something I was toying with for a while, but never really had the kind of impetus to say, okay, let me just go out and do this. But this idea of why don't we have a crowdfunded investigative journalism kind of project which does attempt to basically tackle these controversial issues that the mainstream is too scared to touch and goes into these areas and joins dots and really kind of goes deep into these issues. And that was why I decided to kind of, go down this route of really trying to of move my whole way of doing things away from just pitching to mainstream let me just try and set up something which is independent and going to be publicly funded, so crowdfunded. And so far it's been a real success. I've used this website called patreon.com where basically they have all kinds of creative people, whether they're artists or writers or journalists, who basically try to they have a community of people who love their work, and the idea is that you either pay per product or you pay per month or something like that. So I've got this little community of patrons now who are basically contributing something like, altogether it's about, just in a couple of months that I, since launching the crowdfunder, we've generated $2,000 a month.
I've asked my bookkeeper for us to join, so if we're not one now, we will be shortly. So
That would be amazing. So I mean, so it's all about really trying to shift the way people think about media, trying to encourage people to become involved in media. And it's like what we're saying is, you don't even have to be very much. Like it's one, you can pay anything you want, whether it's if it's per month, you can do as little as $1 a month, or as much as you like. And what I'm trying to do is move towards a point where the more kind of patron subscribers we have, in an ideal scenario, we can reduce the amount that people are actually paying.
Right.
So it's virtually negligible because we have large numbers. And the idea is that once we have enough funds, we're able to kind of set up a proper platform. And then at the moment, it's all about funding my journalism. But ideally, I would love to be able to hire other kind of investigative journalists who are doing important work, which is not getting the attention it deserves, and bring them on board and make their work sustainable. But also, the biggest thing for me is getting people involved, not just in terms of, you know, donating, but getting them involved because they've got ownership. They now have an incentive in a way to be involved in how we craft the platform. You know, how do we want it to look? What kind of stories do you want us to investigate? And, you know, who do you want us to hire? And how do you want us to be able to create and analyze news that is out there? You know, do you want us to set up the platform in different ways? So it's kind of opening up this really exciting way of doing media, and it's an adventure. So I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes.
Well, you keep illuminating the censored stories, Nephi. So.
Thank you.
So I can't think of a more wonderful thing to do with our, you know, our gifting budget than to put some towards your effort. I think Insurge Intelligence is a wonderful idea. We'll have a link to it in the blog post for the Salir Report and to all your other websites as well, and to the Google series. So it'll all be there. In closing, is there any other ideas? I have to make a pitch. Please get off of Gmail and onto StartMail. I can't tell you how many of our subscribers are on Gmail. It just always makes me nervous.
It's definitely an issue. I mean, I'm on Gmail, you know.
Uh-huh.
I didn't expect that I would end up having to have a dilemma about it. It's kind of annoying because, you know, Google is very, very useful. You know, it's a great
tool.
I think as a journalist, you know, I do need to basically think about sensitivity, and I need to basically make sure that I have to protect my sources. So
one of the things I would encourage,
just doing normal communications, but, you know, in terms of other stuff, I can't use Gmail.
One of the things I would encourage you to do is there is a wonderful documentary called Terms and Conditions.
Yeah.
And if you haven't seen it yet, I really encourage you to watch it, because it's about all the, you know, when you use these various tools, the terms and conditions that you really agree to. And it's quite remarkable. So take a look at it if you get a chance.
Okay, I will do, definitely.
Well, Nafis, I can't thank you enough. So keep us posted on what we can do to support you. We'll have all of this up next week in the blog post, and we're in cahoots, okay?
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Have a great day. Bye.